Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, and I will be with you live for the next hour, taking your phone calls, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. We do this show live every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. This show could also be heard on my website at www.europac.net and on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. And, of course, if you missed the show live, you can certainly listen to the archive versions on the website. There is a we archive all the shows. They are there for your, you know, you can get them on iTunes or they're there, the podcasts or whoever they are. So, anyway, the number to call, 888-678-9597. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all my Irish listeners. Anyway, I'm just still trying to log on to my various components. I was involved in this teletown hall right up until the beginning of this show, which is the first time we tried that. It has to do with the Schiff for Senate campaign. For those of you who are following my Senate race, we just had a poll that came out today, and I'm still third in the pack, although I've made a lot of ground. I moved from 4% to 9%, so I've more than doubled my percentages, which is not bad, but still only 15% of the voters have heard of me, so I still have to get my message out, and that just started. My radio commercials started this week. My TV commercials will start before the month is over. My direct mail is just starting, so I think I've got a good message, and when it gets out there, I think a lot of people are going to support me. You know, one of the interesting facts in the poll that came out today is that it showed that my favorables were 10 times my unfavorables among Republicans. So the Republicans that know about me like me. Contrast that to my other two opponents that are beating me. Among Republicans, their favorables are only about four times their unfavorable. So I'm certainly making a lot of headway with the people that know about me. The key is to get more people to know about me, and that is what I am going to do over the course of the next several months. So anybody who wants to help me spread the word, certainly the key is going to be running my TV and radio commercials as often as possible, getting as much mail in the out to voters as possible, and that's going to cost a lot of money. So people want to go to shiftforsenate.com and make a contribution to the campaign. It would be much appreciated, and now's the time to do it because we can use that money, getting it before the end of the quarter here and using it to finance these commercials and make some more headway in the polls. I really think that this race is winnable. I think the key is just going to be to really get the message out there via the media, which is what I'm this point forward. I think I'm starting with a pretty good base of support now without having spent any money on advertising. Anyway, let's talk about the markets a little bit. You know, I also want to call everybody's attention. You know, I read an op-ed piece, not an op-ed piece, it's a column and opinion piece written by Paul Krugman, who I have criticized often. You know, he actually won a Nobel Prize. And I mentioned in my video blog recently that I thought his most recent column should require him to return that prize. And I would hope that the Nobel Committee would at least contact him and ask for it back. But I recorded a long video blog about it. So rather than just rehashing it here on the show, I would invite people to go to my YouTube channel, The Schiff Report, and just play that 10-minute video clip. I've also decided to devote this week's commentary to that Krugman piece. So it should be up on the EuroPac website by tomorrow. And so if you go there, EuroPac.net, you can read the column and definitely watch that YouTube video, because what he said was real complete and utter nonsense. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people, even those without Nobel Prizes, subscribe to that nonsense. So it's important that we focus it, because it is a very dangerous idea. And to the extent that that idea takes hold, we are in serious, serious trouble, as if that wasn't already the case. But this just makes it worse. Meanwhile, I wrote last week in my commentary on my site that I thought the dollar was looking like it was topping out, and that the rally that had been in place over the past couple of months looked to me like it was running out of steam. And it still looks that way. I think that we are in the process of forming what looks like to be a head and shoulders top in the dollar index from this dollar rally. Meanwhile, other currencies, like the Canadian dollar, has made successive new 52-week highs. It made another 52-week high today. Some of these other commodity currencies, like the Aussie, New Zealand dollars, haven't made new 52-week highs, but they seem to have broken out of some overhead resistance. And I think, you know, those currencies are leading. I think also we had an oversold condition in the euro and even in the British pound, which, you know, Great Britain has a number of problems. But I expect to see a rebound in that currency based on the number of people that have sold it. So I think the dollar is poised technically to reverse here. And once the dollar starts to decline, I think that is going to, you know, cause more problems here in the U.S., because it is going to put upward pressure on prices in this country, particularly for commodities, energy. That's why you see oil prices now back at $83 a barrel and rising. Oil is about as high as it's been. I think it looks like it's headed up to $90 in the very near term, and then ultimately much higher than that. Also, the weaker dollar will put upward prices on other commodities, agriculture commodities, and it will put upward pressure on interest rates. And that will, if the Fed wants to try to maintain these artificially low levels of interest rate, it is going to require a greater monetization of debt. The Fed is going to have to be expanding its balance sheet even more rapidly now than it has in the past, and that is going to send some very, very frightening signals to dollar holders all around the world, which will only accelerate their desire to sell the dollar and get out of U.S. debt instruments. And I do think that that will refocus the attention on the U.S. and our credit problems and take the spotlight off the lesser problems in other countries like Greece. You know, and one of the reasons that, you know, the dollar escaped that scrutiny for a while was because people were fixated on Greece and the implications for the euro, and more recently the problems in Great Britain. And so people have taken their eye off the real problem, but I think a weakening dollar is going to refocus their attention as you know, our problems once again take center stage. And again, it is so amazing how many people. You know, I was on CNN the other day again with a guy, Ned Reilly, who's a real nice guy. I mean, I like Ned, but Ned is one of these guys that he was always so bullish. I mean, every time I came on CNBC, and that's where I debated him a lot, and you can see a lot of these clips. They're all up there on YouTube, but they're on the EuroPac site. He was just so optimistic. I mean, he was always with a smile. Everything was great. It was all sunshine and rainbows and stocks were going to go up. The economy was in great shape. It couldn't be better. Everything was fantastic. And he had that attitude, you know, right up until the collapse. I mean, he always stuck to it. And, of course, I'm on with him again, and it's exactly the same. It's like nothing has happened. Everything is great. Everything is perfect. It's going to get better. And, you know, the people who think the economy is recovering, that think we're back on the right track, are the same people who didn't realize we were on the wrong track. You know, when we were headed for a brick wall, or, you know, headed for the edge of a cliff. So people who think that the economy is recovering because we're spending more money, right, because consumers are buying more stuff that they can't afford, this is a good thing, or that they've got housing prices to rise because they've put more subsidies, they don't understand the root cause of the problems. And they don't see that we're adding debt as an economy at a faster rate now than ever before. And, of course, the bigger problem is the debt is on the part of the federal government, which means it's all of our debt. When the private sector was adding a lot of debt, it was a private problem. Now it's a public problem. Now it's a national problem because we've had to add so much debt into the system to try to, you know, postpone the consequences of the unwinding of this bubble that we've made the situation so much worse. And the fact that for a short period of time, we're able to spend more borrowed money and pretend that we solved our problems when our problems are actually growing, when we're deeper in debt than we were ever before, we've dug ourselves into a bigger hole. And people also overlook what is happening in Washington, how much Washington has grown. You know, on the campaign trail, one of the things I've been stumping, one part of my speech is to point out that the federal government is now twice the size it was 10 years ago. Twice the size. We're spending $3.8 trillion, almost $4 trillion. We were still spending less than $2 trillion a year in 1999. And so the government has doubled in size. And how can we afford that? I mean, the government was huge 10 years ago, and now it's twice as huge. Meanwhile, the stock market is about the same as it was 10 years ago. A lot of Americans earn less than they did 10 years ago. In fact, a lot of Americans earn a lot less because they're unemployed. How can all these Americans, all these unemployed Americans, afford a government that's twice the size it was 10 years ago? The answer is we can't. And trying to sustain that government is what's destroying our economy. It's sucking the lifeblood out of the economy. The government is having to usurp whatever resources we have in order to maintain its own existence and continue to grow. It's feeding off the private sector and diminishing it. And the fact that so many people on Wall Street fail to comprehend the gravity of this threat, which is very real, and compound that on the size of the deficit, the amount of money that we're borrowing, our annual budget deficits are now $1.5 trillion a year. I mean, think about that. I mean, it wasn't too long ago. It was in sometime, I don't remember the exact year, but it happened in the 1990s that the whole federal budget finally got to $1.5 trillion. So we're now borrowing every year an amount that used to be the entire federal budget when Bill Clinton was in the White House. I mean, this is preposterous. The government is actually spending $1.60 for every dollar it collects in taxes. I mean, we have gone off the charts here, and if we don't do something fast, this is going to be horrific. And Wall Street is whistling past this graveyard like – there's no problem, that this is all great, that the stock market's going to go up, that the economy is going to recover. None of that is even possible. We can't have a recovery, and a recovery is 100% impossible given the monetary and fiscal policy we have. Yes, they can encourage a little bit more consumption. We can have a little blip in the GDP because we go deeper into debt and spend more money. But the consequences are horrific, that whatever time we buy comes at a dear, dear price, that the next leg down, it's not just going to be, you know, this a double dip recession. The next dip is going to be worse than the first dip, right? We're going lower because of all the things that we've done to create this phony bounce, this phony spurt of excess consumption fueled by debt. And it's not just excess consumption, it's excess government, right? The debt is buying us more government, which is the last thing we want. We want less government, right? The only way to really stimulate the economy is to shrink government. That's the only stimulus that's going to work. But we're doing the opposite. We're growing the government and pretend that that's going to stimulate the economy. That's going to sedate the economy. That's going to suffocate the economy. That's going to destroy the economy. And it's too bad that, you know, that so few people can actually see what should be painfully obvious, especially given the events of the last few years. You would have thought that somebody would have learned something from these mistakes. But unfortunately, nobody learned anything. And, that's one of the reasons that I'm trying to go from the private sector to the public sector, trying to go to Washington, D.C., to try to pound some sense into the heads of our leaders, because they obviously have none right now. Anyway, let me open it up and start taking your phone calls. First up is Ben in North Dakota. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, Mr. Schiff. I've got a couple of questions for you here. I've heard you in the past saying that China's been buying up gold and stuff and diverting its domestic gold production. How they've been buying the dips. I've been curious here. I've kind of been wondering if with the price of silver not being at a new high, wouldn't the Chinese, trying to diversify, be buying that up and driving the price up of the price of silver as well as
they don't want to drive the price up. I mean, that's part of the problem is, you know, if they try to diversify their reserves into silver, I mean, look out. I mean, silver prices would go ballistic. I mean, the biggest problem for China, at least, is they want to buy a lot more gold, but they don't want to drive the price up before they buy it. In fact, that's one of the reasons that China recently talked down gold. They said, oh, we don't really want any gold. I mean, we don't think it's a good investment. I mean, they're saying that because they want to buy it, right? I mean, they have $2.5 trillion worth of reserves, and they only have about 1.5% of their reserves in gold. China has the smallest percentage gold reserves of any central bank in the world, right? I don't want to change that, but the problem is their reserves are so huge that trying to move even, you know, 10% of those reserves, which would still, you know, they would still own a lot less than most developed countries. It's an enormous amount to buy. So they have to be very quiet. They got to buy on the back foot, and they've got to try, they've got to try to talk against what they're trying to do, you know, which is, you know, verbally beat the price of gold down and then, you know, secretly buy it, which is probably what they're doing.
So do you think they are buying silver?
I'm sure. I mean, they're buying resources. I mean, I think they're going to start buying mining companies. I mean, they should be buying more of the mining companies because, you know, then you get their reserves. You get all the gold and silver they've got in the ground. And then simply it's just a function of producing the gold and silver, and then you don't have to buy it. Like if you buy a gold mine, you know, and as that mine is producing gold, you don't have to buy it. You can just, you know, direct it right into your vault so it never actually goes out into the market. And to me, it seems like that's the cheapest way for China to acquire gold is to buy the companies. So China itself right now is the world's biggest gold producer. They've surpassed South Africa. So I'm sure a lot of the gold that is coming out of Chinese mines is making its way directly into their vaults.
Mm-hmm. And then one more question about now with China and their bonds here. One thing I'm wondering here is I'm wondering how many of their bonds are like T-bills and how many are in 30-year bonds. Are they perhaps, you know, keeping the game going while they let their 30-year bonds mature, roll over into shorter-term T-bills, which then gives them an easier exit strategy?
Yeah, well, they are not buying the 30-year bonds.
Yeah, the majority
of what China owns is real short-term stuff.
But yeah, don't they also have some 30-year bonds too that they're just
I mean, I'm sure they have some that they bought that are nearing maturity that they bought, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, but I would guess that most of the 30-year government bonds that Chinese still own were probably not bought 30 years ago. They're probably not nearing maturity, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Chinese government were swapping those longer-dated securities, selling those, and then buying shorter-date securities. See, the big difference between having the long-term bonds and the short-term bonds is, let's assume they had a bunch of 30-year bonds, and they wanted to get out. They would actually have to sell them. They would actually have to find buyers, which would drive bond prices down. And so they might not get 100 cents on the dollar. They might only get 50 cents on the dollar. And, of course, the U.S. government doesn't have to buy them. You know, once you sell a 30-year bond, you don't have to pay it off for 30 years. You just have to pay the interest. So if China wants to sell it, they have to sell it to somebody else. And if the price collapses, it's China's loss. It doesn't affect the United States government. But when you have a treasury bill where it only matures in a year, then China doesn't have to worry about it. They just wait a year, and then they get their money. They turn it in, and we have to pay them back. So the fact that the Chinese have short-term maturities, that is a big problem for the United States because they don't have to sell. All they have to do is let their bonds mature, and we have to give them the face value unless we default.
So if they do have any 30-year bonds, they're probably trying to sell them on the secondary market then. So.
Exactly. They're probably unloading those. And you know who's probably buying them up? The Federal Reserve. You know, they've been expanding their balance sheet. They're trying to keep Treasury rates artificially low to keep this bubble economy inflating. And that is going to be problematic for us. I mean, the United States government, I compare it to, we are on the biggest adjustable rate mortgage of all time, the mother of all adjustable rate mortgages. The Chinese have given us a teaser rate, but they can take that teaser rate away any time. And when this thing resets, we cannot afford to make the payments.
All right. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for calling. Much appreciated. Next up is Joe in North Carolina.
Hey, Peter.
Hiya, Joe.
Two questions. I read that even if China wanted to dump the dollar, the world is so awash in dollars that even their massive amount is a percentage, a small percentage of what is in the world. Is that true?
I don't think so. I mean, they're our biggest creditor. I mean, they have a trillion of them. I mean, that's not chump change by any means.
But worldwide, could there be, let's say, 30 trillion out there that, you know?
It is a big deal. And as cost, it's on the margin. You know, remember, if right now the U.S. government is trying to sell about $1.5 trillion of new bonds to fund the budget deficit, plus, you know, in the next year, at least $1 trillion or $2 trillion of existing debt is going to mature. So the U.S. government has to sell $2 or $3 trillion worth of bonds every year. If the Chinese decide they don't want to buy, and in fact, if they try to sell some of their bonds, I mean, you can't fund it. I mean, meanwhile, Social Security has to start selling bonds right now because Social Security has run out of money. You know, Social Security has been bankrupted on an actual basis for a long time. It has $10 trillion in unfunded liabilities, but it's finally this year that they've actually run out of cash. I mean, Social Security is bankrupt now on a cash flow basis. It's exactly at the same point where Bernie Madoff had to turn himself in. That's where we are. I mean, so this whole thing is unraveling. And so in order to maintain it, we need all the bond buyers out there. We need the Chinese. We need everybody buying our bonds. Of course, I don't want anybody to buy our bonds because all that does is prolong the pain. All that does is enable the government to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which ultimately weakens the economy even further. And the day when they stop buying our bonds, which is inevitable, then the pain is that much worse.
And also, I read today that the Senate's trying to pass a bill that will impose tariffs on China should they not choose to unpeg their currency from the dollar. I don't know if you've read that or not, but what implications does that have?
Well, look, I think that's all a bunch of talk. I don't think we are going to, impose these tariffs. I mean, it doesn't hurt the Chinese. It hurts Americans. It simply makes Chinese products more expensive for American consumers. I mean, how's that going to hurt the Chinese? You know, and of course, we risk, pissing off the Chinese. And that's the last thing that we want to do because they hold all the cards in this relationship. You know, that's the point of my refutation to Krugman's speech. So I think our leaders actually understand where their bread is buttered. They want to talk tough with the Chinese, but they're not going to do anything. I mean, they're too scared to do anything.
So you don't think that'll ever pass through?
I don't think so. I think they'd be too frightened about the negative repercussions from that.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for your time, Peter.
Sure thing. Next up is going to be. Let me see who's on the. Who's on this? Next up is going to be Brad in North Carolina.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for taking the call. I was wondering, I've been hearing and reading your website today about wealthy people walking away from their homes. And I heard it again today on another news radio show. But I'm wondering where you see the end game there if people are walking away from second homes. And I guess in my mind, I'm thinking the banks really don't have much skin in the game as it is because they end up with the property back and short sell.
Yeah, well, as far as wealthy people walking away from their homes, it's all going to depend on the type of mortgage they have. If they have a non-recourse mortgage where the lender can only look to that property to get their money and they can't look beyond it at the individual's other assets, then it's simply a financial decision, right? If you have a $500,000 mortgage on a $300,000 property, why wouldn't you walk away?
I mean, I agree.
People are making a financial decision that the house is not an asset, it's a liability. And if you could walk away from a liability, why not? And the government has made it very easy because they passed a law two years ago, and it's still in effect, that if you walk away from a loan, that none of it is taxable income to you. Before the government passed that loan, if you borrowed $500,000 and didn't pay it back, you know, whatever you didn't pay back was counted as ordinary income. And so this law turned that away. So there is absolutely no reason for somebody not to walk away from a mortgage that's non-recourse. Now, if it's a recourse loan, then obviously if you have a lot of other assets, the lender could come after you. But for a lot of Americans, even if they have a recourse loan, if they're broke, if they have credit card debt and auto loans on top of their mortgage, then, you know, the banks can't do anything. They have no collateral. So a lot of people are making that decision. And that was my point years ago before the bubble burst. I said that the problem is people are buying homes with nothing down. They got no skin in the game. The minute the market turns, they're going to walk. You know, people were getting suckered into the real estate game because they were told they were going to get rich. Buy this house and you're going to get rich. Well, the minute that wasn't turning out, a lot of these home buyers really didn't want these homes. They'd rather rent. They were buying to get rich. The minute they couldn't get rich, why make the payments? You know, especially if they finance with a teaser rate or an interest-only mortgage, and now the payments balloon up to a bigger number. You know, they're upside down in the mortgage. What incentive do they have to struggle to make these huge payments when there's a huge glut of apartments and houses for rent that you can go and rent without any of the hassle for a lot less money?
Well, I agree wholly, man. There's no doubt everybody's thinking the exact same thing, especially people that can pay aren't paying. So,
and that is the real reason.
Where do you think it's going to end up, though? Where will it end, Peter?
It's going to end. I think it's going to.
But everybody gets crushed in this game. If one guy walks away from a neighborhood of 15 houses, then 14 houses lose value. The bank gets the house back, and they don't care what the price is.
But you know what? Let's think about this. Does it really matter, you know, what if you're living in a house, right? Does it really matter what the house is worth? It only matters if you're trying to. It only matters if you're trying to sell it. But if you're just living there, what difference does it make what it's worth? You know, and the thing is, we're trying to maintain these artificially high prices. You know, if the government got out of the way and all these bailouts, bank bailouts, it's not about homeowners. It's about the lenders. It's trying to keep the lenders solvent.
Absolutely.
You know, let's assume you're already underwater. If I have a $500,000 mortgage and my house is worth $400,000, do I care if that house goes to $200,000? What difference does it make? It's underwater is underwater. In fact, as the owner of that house, I'm better off if the price goes to $200,000 because now I've got a lot of leverage with the borrower. He won't dare foreclose on me. What's the point? What's he going to get? He's more likely to negotiate with me and to restructure the mortgage to a reasonable level.
You know, I'm sorry, man, but I think you're wrong there because I think the banks are willing to take the property if they think they can sell it at whatever price because they're just cash hungry.
The
government helped them make their balance sheets look good, whatever that took.
Right.
And it doesn't matter. If they can somehow suck more blood out of the economy, or rather more cash out of the economy, then they'll do it, including short sales. I think they care less about the value of the property than you and I.
No, but if they did enough of those short sales, the banks would go under. They'd be insolvent. They would lose much money that they would go out of business.
Well, they've proved to us they can't go under. Hey, thanks for taking my call, Peter. I was wondering, why don't you just run for president?
Well, let's see if I can get elected to the Senate.
Serious,
one step at a time.
I've been listening to you for years, and you've been telling us, hey, there's no point in being number 100. It's just, you know, it was pointless. People were asking you to do it, and you said, that's pointless. And that made great sense to me. And I'm thinking, man, why didn't you just run for president?
Well, there is no presidential election in 2010. So let's see if I can get elected.
There will be. Yeah.
Let's see if the country is ready to elect me senator first.
All right.
But
all right,
I appreciate the sentiment.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you. Next up is going to be John calling from Toronto, Canada, where the Canadian dollar is now ready to break through the one-to-one barrier again with the dollar, and maybe this time it'll never look back and just keep on rising because, unfortunately, Canada is, you know, a model of fiscal prudence next to the United States. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. Well, Canada may be of fiscal prudence, but it's all, I think, in the concept of how everybody looks at everything, the way the world's going today.
Well, it's all relative.
It's all relative. And unfortunately, Canada's been more prudent than everyone else has been less prudent, but that doesn't make them any better as far as everything that you preach. I'm actually calling maybe to support, even from Canada, where everyone thinks that Canada is the greatest country in the world, which I do agree that it is. But I'm a businessman, ex-businessman. I ran a mechanical contracting company here, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, sheet metal. One thing that people have to understand is, you know, as governments run, not just the Canadian, U.S., anyone, when governments are trying to take care of people and running deficits, on the political front and the front end, they, you know, they promise tax cuts, they promise everything else. But as a company owner, little do you realize, you know, you got 30 trucks leaving your shop in the morning, and all 30 of them are being pulled over, and they're looking underneath them to see if there's a muffler hanging off it. You got two guys in your truck, you're paying them $35 an hour, and we have that big time up here. I'm sure you're probably going to have that big time down there, but it's the smoke and mirrors part of you're getting more and more government and less workers, and just what you're saying. I've noticed.
Yeah, we got more people taken out of the pot and fewer people putting into the pot. Eventually, the pot's going to be empty. That's
exactly
the problem.
I started my business in 1988, right when we had the huge commercial real estate bubble that had just burst, and built that business. As I saw things going, I said to my partner, I said, you know, we got to sell this business because this is crazy. And over time, you know, I got to the point where I could see it, and that was 6 years ago. And my partner wanted to keep continuing on, so he bought me out, and I left. And but, I mean, you just, the things that you see as a company owner that you have to go through, it's just like now you got your safety committee guys coming in onto you. You've got, they're pulling your trucks over every day looking for things that you've already paid for twice over to have safety requirements, and you've got all the tickets, but they still have extra people on there. And I'm saying to my partner, like, I mean, I'm not going to work for the government. And I mean, I'm a, you know, I'm a competent person. I could hire hundreds of people and run a business. And but when I see that kind of stuff and you scare people like me away, I'm sure there's more people like me out there that are going to do exactly the same thing. I know my partner now wishes that he had did what I did back then, because it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, look, the government is the biggest enemy of entrepreneurs, of business. You know, the minute you decide to start a business in the United States, I mean, you're immediately subjected to all sorts of rules, regulations, requirements, taxes, legal liability, fines. You know, it's amazing that anybody does it. And, of course, a lot fewer people do it, and a lot fewer people are successful at it because of all the extra obstacles the government throws in your path. And, you know, and of course, from a political standpoint, you know, it makes more sense to try to appeal to employees than employers, because employees generally outnumber employers. There are more people who work for people than employ people. And so politicians try to play into that by talking about, oh, workers' rights. Well, you know, I don't believe workers have any special rights because they are workers. They have the same rights that everybody has. They have individual rights, and you have those rights whether you choose to be an employee or an employer. You don't gain special rights because you take a job, and you don't lose rights and because you decide to hire somebody. But that's how we make it look. And, you know, the riskiest thing you can do in America is hire somebody, because you subject yourself to all sorts of rules and regulations, and you open yourself up to meritless and all sorts of lawsuits. You know, it's terrible, and we need to move away from that kind of culture soon, because otherwise, I mean, we are in serious, serious trouble.
Well, my point, I guess, is there's people that employ and there's people that work for others, and people like myself that will not stay in that camp when it's just too much overburden.
Well, of course,
to employ. And I'm sure,
you know,
that I'm not the only one in this world that's like that, and in North America that's like that. And the more of us that do what I'm doing, there's going to be a lot less work for people to do, and a lot less, you know, there's going to be a lot
more
government.
if we all want to vilify and punish employers, they'll stop employing, and then all the jobs will be gone. I mean,
exactly.
You know, that's the key. I mean, you have to understand that if you want a job, somebody has to be prepared to create it for you and give it to you.
Well, that's
and
right.
We can't be looking to punish or vilify the people who do that, because, you know, nobody has a right to a job, right? Everybody has a right to work, right? But you don't have a right to work for somebody else. You have a right to work for yourself. Nobody can stop you from, you know, going out and working. But if, you know, a job is something that somebody has to voluntarily offer you and decide to give you a paycheck. And if people want that, if people want the ability to be able to collect the paycheck, then people have to, you know, be there to supply it, to take all the risks, to supply all the capital. And the more difficult the government makes it to do that, the harder it is, the more we tax, the more we regulate, the more we litigate, the fewer people are going to do that, and the fewer job opportunities that they're going to exist.
Well,
anyway,
agree.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, Peter. Good luck on your election campaign.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all your support on that end. Anyway, next up, we've got an international caller. I want to let him break through, calling from, of all places, Greece. Go ahead, Charles. Do I have Charles on the air?
Oh, man, I thought after hanging on all this time, I thought you just lost me, but you did not.
Is this calling Charles?
Yes, it is. You want to buy the Acropolis?
No, but I might be interested in one of those islands. I think I've been to the Greek islands, and I know there's a bunch of small uninhabited ones. Maybe there's one that they can put up on the block that I might have an interest in.
It just might happen.
When the United States is going to start selling off our national monuments and national parks. Yeah.
Well, it's a mess everywhere, no doubt. I just wanted to ask you a few quick questions. You answer these almost every week, but the answer, I think, changes pretty quickly. Long term, if you are absolutely forced to keep your money in fiat currencies, what are your top choices?
Well, you know, if you look at the currencies that we're buying, you know, at Europe Pacific Capital, we're certainly buying a lot of Asian currencies, Hong Kong, Singapore, getting exposed to the Chinese RMB. We're buying the commodity currencies like Australia, Canada. We're buying Scandinavia. We're buying a lot of Norwegian krona, Swiss francs. You know, we're in, you know, a basket of currencies, mainly through the securities that we buy. We mainly buy stocks for people. But other clients, we buy fixed income. We buy government bonds and corporate bonds in those countries to get people income and to keep their principal in those currencies.
The euro, we've pretty much lost confidence in. Is that correct?
No, well, I'm still buying euros. I mean, you know, I it's not my favorite currency, but we own euros. We have some investments in Germany and France and the Netherlands, and so those securities pay in euros.
Okay. Any specific jurisdictions? Are you allowed to even give an opinion on that? Any areas?
I mean, as
of the
I said,
world?
In the eurozone, I am staying away from countries like Greece, you know, that have a lot of fiscal problems that theoretically could ultimately, you know, leave the eurozone and they could recreate the drachma. And I certainly don't want to own drachma. So,
are you okay with Switzerland, for example?
Yeah, I mean, we have investments in Switzerland, and you know, we have Swiss. To get the specific strategy and the specific ideas, I would suggest that you contact my company and talk to one of the brokers. You know,
well,
we can take accounts
from.
That's
my final question. Is there any chance you'll ever open an office outside of the States?
Well, I am opening up a Euro-Pacific Canada, which should, I think it's supposed to open up maybe as early as June of this year. And, yeah, ultimately, I would like to have offices outside the United States. I don't know when I might have. Greece is probably not high on my list, but I'd certainly like to have some kind of European location. For the company, as we expand, at some point we will be doing that. But in the meantime, we can still work with people in Europe through the offices here in the U.S. You can call, you know, the direct line. I know the number is in my Connecticut office is 203-662-9700. 203-662-9700, and I know from there, that switchboard, you can access all six of the offices that we have here in the States. I don't think the toll-free number works from international.
Okay, well, if you wanted to deal through Canada, that's just an equal way to keep your money technically offshore, is it not?
Right, but the Canadian firm is set up for Canadians, American citizens, based on the rules that Canada and the United States have. The Canadians are not allowed to do business down here, and the Americans are not allowed to do business up there. So I think a lot of Canadians are going to be opening, but certainly from Greece, you could pick and choose. You can do business with Euro Pacific Capital in the U.S., or you could probably do business with Euro Pacific Canada.
Not to insult anybody, but I'd prefer to have kept it outside of the United States. You know, people are trying to get out of the States. You know, I think it's kind of still going to be bringing it in, at least just my opinion.
Yeah, well, if that's your concern, sure, then open up the account with Canada, you know.
I had no idea you had a Canadian firm. That's
well, not
news.
Yet. It doesn't exist yet, but it will shortly.
Well, work on the European one, will you?
All right, thanks for the call.
All right, I thank you. Bye-bye.
I know before I take the next call, it might be a good opportunity, now that we talked investments a little bit, to interject my disclaimer, just to warn everybody that, when you're listening to this financial program, you are listening to Peter Schiff's opinions. These are my personal opinions. And, of course, everything that I say could be wrong. I could be completely wrong on my understanding of economics. I could be completely wrong in what I think is going to happen in the global economy, what I think is going to happen to the dollar, what I think is going to happen to gold or the stock market. So obviously, if you follow my economic reasoning and you make investment decisions based on my opinions and those opinions turn out to be wrong, well, you could lose a lot of money. If you decide to, invest internationally and the dollar goes up instead of down, well, you'll lose. Or if foreign stocks go down, you'll lose. Or there's a whole bunch of ways that I could be wrong and that you could lose. So, but if you want to get real specific information on investment strategies that I believe in, don't just listen to this program. Call up Euro Pacific Capital at 800-727-7922. Speak with a licensed stockbroker who can speak to you individually, understand what your own objectives are, what your risk tolerance is, explain my philosophy, what I do, what I recommend, and what the risks are, so that you know what you're looking at, and make an informed decision about what risks you want to accept and what risks you want to try to guard against. Do you want the risks? Do you want to accept the risks that the dollar collapses and keep your money here, or are you worried about the dollar collapsing and are you willing to assume different risks? Are you willing to assume the risks that foreign currencies go down, or the risk that gold goes down, or the risk that stocks go down? There's risks in everything we do, and we all have to decide for ourselves which risks we want to accept and which risks we want to do our best to avoid. Also, you can get more information on my strategy by reading my books. Crash Proof 2.0, if you haven't read that book, pick up a copy. And if you had read that book and you liked it, I only have about 50-odd reviews on Amazon for Crash Proof 2.0. I had over 350 for the original Crash Proof. So if you've liked the book and you haven't written a review, or if you wrote a review for the original, why not go on Amazon and write another review? So let's get a few more reviews up there to show the people on Amazon that people are reading this book. I asked to take all the reviews from the first one if they can move them to the second one, and they couldn't do that. So I like to get some of those. There was a lot of really good reviews that we got up there on the original Crash Proof. And speaking about books, my next book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, that book is pretty much all done. We finished the cover, just a couple more things. It is scheduled, I think, to be released by April. I think early April the book is going to be out. I think that's great. It'll be out during this Senate campaign. I think the book can be helpful in the campaign. It really explains economics in a way that a lot of voters will be able to understand. So I hope we can really get this book out there, out around the country, and certainly in the hands of a lot of Connecticut voters, who I think it would do a lot to educate them on economics and get them to understand my perspective and why I need to be their next senator. Anyway, next up we have another Canadian caller, Brian from Alberta. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, Peter, can you hear me?
I can.
Awesome. Great job on that debate, Peter. You did. I can't stop watching that. You did such a good job.
Oh, thank you. It's unfortunate that more people, not only didn't they see that debate, but they didn't even read about it. Because in this most recent poll that I mentioned earlier today, 85% of registered voters in the state of Connecticut still don't know who I am, despite the fact that there were front page stories on every Connecticut newspaper the day after the debate about how I won it. And these are registered voters, and 85% of them don't even read the paper.
I've been reading
so obviously I got my work cut out for me here.
Yeah, they're hardly mentioning you, and I think that might be on purpose.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, what's your question? I need your personal opinion on this. I'm Canadian. I've got some stocks in Hong Kong and in Singapore. When your dollar starts to slide, when it crashes like we know it's gonna, are people going to rush out of equities into dollars or money that they trust, or are they going to be rushing into equities because they don't know what else to do?
Well, we know what happened last time in 2008, right? Everybody rushed into the dollar, and stocks went down, commodities went down, gold went down, and the dollar went up. That's what they did in 2008. Now, you know, I didn't expect that to happen, and that's what happened. Now, I don't expect that to happen again. Right, and maybe I'm going to be fooled twice. Maybe I'm going to be wrong twice on this. Maybe there is another rush to the dollar coming, but you know, one of these days they're going to rush in the other direction. I bet that that's going to happen sooner, not later. I wouldn't want to take a chance. I think the real risk is that when people figure out this game, that it's the dollar that collapses, and it's everybody's trying to get rid of their dollars and buy whatever they can with them.
Yeah, I was interested in that because I was worried that people were going to rush into Canadian dollars and our dollar was going to get really strong. And
well, there's nothing wrong with that. When the Canadian dollar goes up, Canadians get richer. Things get cheaper. It's like everything goes on sale. You know, when your currency goes up, it's like everything that you want to buy is on sale. Why is that a bad thing? Everybody likes when things are on sale. No one likes it when prices go up, right? If you go to a store and you say, well, we're going to mark it up. It's an extra 10% today. No one's going to be happy about that, but if they cut the price and they have a sale, then everybody likes that. But when it comes to exchange rates, somehow economists have got us to think that if our currency goes up, it's a bad thing, and if it goes down, it's a good thing. It makes no sense. You know, strength is good. Weakness is bad.
I was worried because I already bought the stocks, and now I want to buy some more, and I'm not sure if I should do it now or later, and you guys haven't opened up your Canadian office yet, and I'm just sitting here twitching.
Well, it does. If you're buying a Hong Kong stock or an Australian stock or any stock, it doesn't matter whether you buy it through my Canadian office or the U.S. office. It's the same stock. The only reason to worry, theoretically, about having your money in the U.S. is in case the U.S. government decides to seize it. But the asset is the asset, no matter where you hold it. The main thing is, if you're Canadian, right, you know, Canadian law prohibits you from just opening up an account with us. Unless you also have a house down here or if you happen to be an American citizen that's up there. But that's the reason that this Canadian office is opening up, to accommodate, you know, all the Canadians over the years that have wanted to do business with me, but because of laws, they've been restricted from doing so.
Okay, so the key is to just keep buying. Just buy.
Yes, that's what I think.
All right, perfect. That's what I wanted to know.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
You.
Next call is going to be Dale from California.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Dale.
I saw the debate, too, and I thought you did a great job. You know, one observation, I noticed that when you're talking about economic issues, you just can't be beat. You know, anybody that really studies Austrian economics, they can't be stumped by any question. And that's when you're the most passionate. When they get into other questions, whether it be abortion or Iran or something, I feel maybe there's a little energy going out of your performance. And I was thinking that maybe at some point, once you get to be a threat, they'll try to probe for the weak spot, you know, where you are. And I can almost see the wheels turning in your head, like you're thinking we've got this vampire government on our neck, and yet we're talking about abortion or other things that aren't even a congressional issue.
I'm looking at, you know, I don't think I'm weak on other issues. I just think that I want to focus on the main issue, which is the economy. It's like, you know, we're on a ship that's sinking. I want to focus on the gaping hole in the hull and not the color of the upholstery on the drapes on the portholes. So, you know,
that's
the real key.
That's my question for you, is how do you plan to refocus on the number one thing that we all should be talking about when they try to drag you into these other areas?
But they don't try to. I'm focusing on the economy. 70% of the people that we poll and that says the economy is the number one issue, and I'm focusing on what's on everybody's mind, and it's where I stand out because I have a knowledge of economics that my competitors don't have. And after all, the economic crisis when nobody else did. So I must know something about economics to have been able to do that. So I'm focusing on that. And by the way, I'm headed out to California on Saturday. I'm going to be out there all of next week. This is my first campaign fundraising. We have a number of fundraisers out there. I'll be stopping by my Los Angeles offices and my brand new Newport Beach office. I haven't even seen it yet. We moved offices in Newport Beach. I haven't even been by the new one. It's supposedly really nice. So I want to go check it out. And so I will be out there, and I'll be out there for my birthday, too, which is March 23rd. I am turning 47 years old, getting very close to 50, which is a very scary thought for me.
Well, we've got a terrible situation out here in California. We've got Meg Whitman versus Jerry Brown, and they're in dead heat. Neither one of them is, you know, this is a terrible Hobson's choice for us. We don't even have a version of you to compete for governor. So we're in a bad situation out here.
Yeah, well, California is in serious trouble. I mean, you know, it is, you know, the Greece of the United States, or one of the many Greeces, unfortunately. You know, and yeah, I mean, it is a mess in the state of California, and you know, hopefully something can be done, but I'm afraid that that, you know, they're going to be asking for a federal bailout, and I'm afraid that they'll get it. That's even the worst part.
When's your next debate?
I don't know. I don't know if anybody wants to debate me. I mean, we've had invitations. Nobody seems to accept them. I don't know why my opponents would want to debate me, because they're just going to lose. And meanwhile, I'm in last place. I'm in third place right now. Any opportunity to debate them is an opportunity for me to gain votes. And obviously, why would they want to give me that opportunity? So I think that they're going to try to minimize the debates. They'll probably say, look, we had a debate. That's all we need. And I'm going to try to get as many debates as possible. I'd have a debate every day if it was up to me, because eventually somebody might watch it. That's the only thing that my opponents have going for them on the debates, is that not that many people actually watch. So they're not going to damage themselves too much, because there's not too many people watching.
Are you allowed to solicit the news media for interviews?
Sure. I mean, I get interviews. So, you know, I mean, I do them. I mean, you know, I was on CNN this week. They mentioned that I was a candidate for the United States Senate. Unfortunately, some of my media appearances are being restricted. You know, I had this deal. I was going to be going on CNBC quite a bit, and they put the kibosh on that at the network, because they said, hey, you're a political candidate. We just can't have you on a regular basis. So, you know, I'm probably on television a little bit less as a political candidate than as an economic pundit. But I'm still getting, you know, I still get out there. I do some radio talk shows as a candidate. You know, there are some shows I'm doing here in Connecticut as a candidate that I never did as a stock market pundit or an investment, you know, advisor. So, you know, there's some, it's a trade-off. I'm doing some media and not doing others. But, you know, I'm not really sure, you know, my opponents are not doing a lot of media. I mean, the main difference in this race is that one of my opponents, you know, and everybody know who she is, has spent, you know, over $10 million, I'm sure by now, maybe quite a bit more, on commercials and direct mail and radio. And so, you know, she's bombarded Connecticut, and, you know, people know her name. They don't know my name, you know. And so you support somebody you've heard of, you know. So if only, you know, if 85% of the people haven't heard of me, they ain't going to vote for me, you know.
Right.
And if 60% or 70% of the people have heard of Linda McMahon, well, they'll vote for her. Even if she's not the greatest candidate, I mean, at least they know who she is. Right? They're not going to vote for somebody that, you know, unless she was just such a, you know, unless she was such a bad, you know, candidate that they just, oh, I can't vote for her, so I'll just vote for somebody I don't even know who they are. You know, but that's not the case. I mean, she has, you know, she has a message. Her message in many respects is very similar to mine. You know, I think a lot of it comes from me, to be honest with you. But it's, you know, get rid of the career politicians, get a businessman, we need change, shake things up. I mean, it's a good message. I mean, it's my message, so I know it's good. I just think that it's more genuine coming from me, and I think I'm the one that actually might be able to do something to change Washington. I think she could talk about it, but at the end of the day, I don't really think she's going to be able to pull it off. But I think I can. I think I've got the ability. I think I've got the credentials to pull it off, and the real desire to do it, you know.
I sure hope so.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Bye.
Hey, I know, we're running out of time, so no more calls. We got two callers on hold, so let me go quick. The next one is Jake in North Carolina. Go ahead, Jake.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I have a quick question for you. I'm interested in trying to get into some investments that are going to generate cash flow, but ideally on a monthly basis. And I know that dividend-paying stocks are always a great option, but I was actually considering trying to purchase an apartment building, but I have no desire to do that in the U.S. because I think as inflation starts to hit, I think rent's going to actually go lower. So I was thinking about trying to do it in another country, and certainly I wouldn't be managing the property. I would hire someone to do that. But
what I think you should do if you really want to get into the property market is, you know, at Euro Pacific Capital, now I like commercial property better than residential property. I think the valuations are better, the cash flows are better. We own a lot of property trusts all around the world, and most of them pay dividends either semi-annually, quarterly, annually, but of course they're not all at the same time. And if you build yourself a portfolio, you can own properties in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in Australia, in France, in the Netherlands, in Canada, in Germany, you know, all over the world, and collect rents in Swiss francs, in euros, you know, in Australian dollars, in Norwegian krona. You know, and that's a lot easier. You don't have to hire a manager. You know, it's a portfolio. It's very liquid. I mean, that's the way to go. And, you know, even if you want to go across the board, we own all kinds of stocks. We own toll roads. We own supermarkets. You know, we own food companies. We own agriculture companies, farms, fertilizer companies, oil and gas companies, manufacturing companies, infrastructure companies, all sorts of companies that are paying big dividends on a regular basis. And you can build yourself a portfolio of income-generating assets around the world, whether they're real estate, whether it's utilities, whatever you want, and get the income. And I think it's a lot easier and less expensive than having to acquire a property on your own, you know, have all of your wealth concentrated in just one property, and then right. have to have no liquidity, really, and have to hire somebody to manage it and have to pay insurance and worry about, you know, lawsuits and all kinds of things. But anyway, if you want to get more information again about the particulars, I said call up Euro Pacific Capital. I talk about the risks and the rewards of these type of investments. You can call it 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Hey, I was making time for my last caller. There was another guy from Alberta, Canada, and he finally dropped. He had been hanging on for a while. I'm sorry that the caller dropped because I did make time for that another Canadian. So this is we had three calls from Canada on this show. That's quite a bit. So it's glad to know that I am popular up there, and it's one of the reasons that we are opening Euro-Pacific Canada. So I invite that caller to try again next week, although I'm not sure if I'm going to do the show next week. I will be out in California. I know I'm going to be pretty busy. If I have time, I'll do it. If not, you know, somebody will sub in and do the show for me. Anyway, that's it. Look, I want to remind everybody again, you know, visit the Europac website. Call up. If you don't have an account with us yet, talk to one of the brokers about setting one up. And it's the number 800-727-7922. And as I said, you know, try to pick up if you haven't got Crashproof 2.0, if you're new to this show, that's my, you know, Crashproof was my original book, best-selling book, sold over 200,000 copies now with Crashproof 2.0. But you can get the new version. It's up on the bookstores. You can order it on my website at europac.net, I'm sorry, or Amazon. And as I said, you know, write a review. Get up there on Amazon. We don't have that many reviews there, Crashproof 2.0. We've got 350 of the original one. We need to get some good reviews of Crashproof 2.0. Anyway, as I said, that's it. Make sure everybody tune in again every Wednesday for Wall Street Unspun Midweek Market Roundup. I do this show as often as I can. You know, I apologize when people tune in. They're hoping to hear from me. I get a lot of emails. People are disappointed when I can't do the show. Believe me, I would love to do the show all the time, but I got to do this campaign. And as long as I'm campaigning, I'm out there. I'm traveling to all these towns almost every night. I'm traveling. And so I just can't do it. Anyway, thanks, everybody, for listening. Until next time, again, this is Peter Schiff of Euro Pacific Capital. Call us 800-727-7922. Have a happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Take care and good night.